Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Read Right to Left podcast. I, as always, am G from Simply G, joined by my wonderful co-host, Ray, from Whimsical Pictures.
Hi, everybody.
And this month, had a bit of scheduling mishaps, had to shuffle around a little bit at the last minute, but we are doing a mangaka spotlight for a creator Yay. That I believe Ray and I really both love.
Yes.
Really enjoy a lot of his works. So we will be talking about Taiyo Matsumoto, who is quite prolific in both Japanese and English. We have a majority of his titles, or most notable titles, in English.
Yeah, which is actually crazy to think about.
Yeah.
There's so many that were like white whales for all of us for so long.
Especially because he is certainly not the most mainstream sort of artist. Doesn't necessarily appeal to the more typical manga fan. But hopefully, if you have not read any of his works or experienced any of the adaptations, our discussion today will encourage you to do so, because there's a lot of great stuff and hopefully a lot to talk about.
Yes. With that, where do we want to start from? Do we want to start with, I guess, his most famous work? Which is also one of the earliest ones that we have in English.
I would say so. Again, because we do have now so much of his stuff being released, and being re-released in some cases. But I think it all really starts with his most famous work, one that I think a lot of people discovered through the adaptation as well. And that is, of course, Tekken Kinkri, or Black and White. Fantastic movie, first of all. Highly recommend the film. But also, fantastic manga. Wonderful, complete, done-in-one volume. Released by Viz, oversized, back when they were making pretty interesting choices with certain titles.
And is still that the flipped one?
No, there's a flipped. I believe they initially released it flipped in two or three volumes, to match the Japanese, or well, not obviously to match the volume count of the Japanese, but later down the track, they released it in an unflipped complete volume.
It was interesting because I grabbed this one digitally because I don't have it in my collection, but I'd read it from the library ages ago. Mm-hmm. So I just grabbed it digitally to reread for this podcast. The digital edition reads from right to left, but I guess it's such an early digital book that you have to flip through it left to right.
Hmm.
So, like, the double page spreads are totally whacked because they're, like, backwards. And I was like, oh, yeah, I remember when digital manga was like this.
Yeah, I think that's just a relic of the age of when that was put together. Because, as you mentioned, Ray, this is definitely this is his first major title that saw itself, in English circles. Interestingly enough, the translation was done by the individual who would later on go to direct the film. So obviously a big fan of just Taiyo Matsumoto's work in general. It's a pretty interesting one.
It's almost exemplifying a lot of the things that would come to represent Taiyo Matsumoto's work as well.
Mm-hmm.
I guess as a brief summary of what it's about, it's about a fictional big city that, you know, is not dissimilar from Tokyo, called Treasure Town, that is just a dump, right? It's overrun with crime and poverty, and it stars these two kids named Black and White, who spend their time running across skyscrapers, jumping from streetlight to streetlight. They seem to have some sort of strange abilities. Nobody really knows where they came from, but they grew up on the streets with no family but each other. They call the town their town, and they commit various acts of violence in order to protect what they consider theirs. And they end up getting sort of caught up in, I would say, things that are a lot bigger than either of them can handle.
Much larger, much powerful, much more powerful groups. And coming into direct conflict with those larger and more powerful groups as goals, and therefore becoming a problem for them that they have to get out of. Our main characters are kind of the two titular boys of the series, Black and White, who are not related but sworn brothers. Black is the older of the two. He is a lot more willing to get into trouble in order to protect White, who is not only younger but a little bit more naive and innocent and unsullied by the world. And it's not only a story of these like child gangs and other goings on in the city, but also the yin and yang kind of balance between these two boys and how they support and help each other in unexpected ways, and the power in that which that's done from very different personal places. It's really, really good. And again, recommend the movie. It's a great adaptation.
Yeah. We also have this interplay between, Black being very disillusioned by the adult world, but also finding himself increasingly, blackened, darkened by the shadows of what it means to grow up, essentially. So we get the... And then White, who is very, very childlike, much more childlike than his years would suggest, who is able to hold on to some of that hope of childhood and ends up, being essentially Black's last tether to hope and goodness. Which I think is, if we're talking about Taiyo Matsumoto as a mangaka, that interplay between the shadows of adulthood and the hope and dreams of childhood is a constant conflict within his work.
It's certainly something we see as a very major theme throughout a majority of his titles.
I guess with Tekkon King Crete, how do we feel about ableism? How do we feel about the portrayal of White? 'Cause I have complicated feelings about it.
Yeah, so the portrayal of White, for those who haven't read it, he's sort of, I said naive and unsullied by the world. I mean that almost in a sense of, or the way that he's portrayed is...
He is, like, I would say, definitely neurodivergent in some respect. He's definitely portrayed that way as well. I find him less annoying than some, mysterious neurodivergent secret genius hope of the world characters.
Yes.
You see. Because I do think that there's an effort to show how, like, his neurodivergency makes it difficult for him to navigate some aspects of an ableist world. And meanwhile also showing how, like, it does give him some interesting insights that other people in the story don't have. So he almost feels, even though he's a very over-the-top character, he feels almost more human than some of these, like, you know, inspirational neurodivergent characters.
Well, that also was what I was going to say, is, like, comparatively to some of these, like, magical neurodivergent individuals that I've experienced in the past through various forms of media, he is markedly better. It doesn't mean that it's perfect or that, like, it's, there still isn't issues, but still markedly better compared to, like, Fish from Cloud Street or, God, I can't even, there's so many, so many. But, yeah, there's still issues. It's not, that's not an inherent excuse.
Rather than, like, this weird, like, vehicle for, like, inspiring other people who talks like a strange alien adult, he talks like a kid. Like a kid
yeah.
who just, you know, perceives things differently than Black does, or maybe doesn't always see, like, the big picture that Black wants him to see, but is catching on to things that interest him, and, like, you know. He's, just like with any Taiyo Matsumoto kid character, he's always goofing around and, like, singing dumb songs about boobs. he does come across very honest as, like, a representation of a child of his age. Which, talk about hitting just, like, the lowest possible bar. This is where we're at.
It's still surprising. It's such a low bar, and yet it's still so surprising.
I like, seeing, I guess as a teacher. You're going to hear that a lot in this podcast, as I'm going to be like, well, as a teacher of kids this age. I liked, you know, seeing, like, how White getting some, like, forming some positive bonds with grown-ups, seeing that relationship develop and how it sort of changes both of them, was sweet. So, I always like that kind of thing, so.
And as we mentioned before, a majority of Matsumoto's works do focus on children and child characters and their relationship and perception of the world around them, their relationship with adults in their lives, their relationships with each other. And so, unless there's something like major that you wanted to say more about Tekken King Crete, I think we can...
Just content warnings, I guess. Tekken King Crete, in particular, out of Matsumoto's work, is very, very focused on the, I guess, shocking nature of watching small children perform horrible acts of violence and have horrible acts of violence performed on them. So, not for the faint of heart, I would say. Just a warning going in. I was rereading it, and I was like, yep. This was really hard to read, actually. I forgot.
So from that thread, continuing on with Taiyo Matsumoto's more fantastical works, and also the most recent of his books or series to be released in English, somewhat of a surprise considering this did actually have a previous attempt at publishing by Viz, It only got 2 volumes out before it was scrapped, but because of the renewed interest in Matsumoto's works and the notoriety of some of his other titles, number 5 is the newest of the English releases from him and is the second chance for the series from the same publisher as well, interestingly enough.
Yeah. Number 5. This is... seems to be set within a world that is illustrated by a child. We keep seeing, like, the contrast between, like, what the world looks like, presumably, inside the kid's head and, like, the kid's actual, like, shitty little drawings. which is an interesting sort of artistic choice. I took a lot of screenshots of those. But, yeah, so in terms of story, it very much feels like something that a kid would come up with. There's this world far in the future, I think post-apocalyptic, where the lore of this dystopian society is a little unclear at this moment, but so like you can, you know, fill in whatever lore I'm missing, but essentially the Rainbow Brigade is a group of warriors who protect the peace. Their role seems to be rather disputed and complicated, whether they're just like a figurehead, propaganda, you know, whether they actually have like a role in protecting the peace. But essentially we've got numbers 1 through 9 who are all these respected warriors from their respective parts of the world. And one day number 5 betrays them and runs off with a mysterious woman called Matryoshka. And the rest of the book, because we have the 1 volume out now that covers 2 volumes of the original Japanese release, is just various members of the Rainbow Brigade, specifically moving up the line. So we have numbers 9, 8, and 7 in this volume, going after number 5 to kill him and take the woman back.
It's an interesting one because, from our perspective, we are coming into this series very blind. We, having read just this first 2-in-1 book, we obviously don't know how this is going to completely progress. It's hard to hold a discussion on just one book out of a part of a larger story. It'll be interesting to see how these plot threads continue, considering it is a longer work of Masamoto's. In fact, it's probably the longest of his titles that we've gotten in English, or will get in English. I think there's only one other, his historical manga, that's also 8 volumes, which we don't have, because... yeah, it'll be interesting to see how it develops, because as you said, there's a lot of uncertainty, a lot of kind of confusion as to the ins and outs of the reality of this world and how these characters, I mean, if these characters even exist, to be perfectly honest, and how this childlike adventure will continue on, interspersed with like quite a like it is a child's understanding of a internal skirmish with, you know, certain
members. So it's like everyone's reasons are a bit like shallow or alien, but then the violence is just like super violent.
Yeah, we're just gonna have a gunfight, and then, you know, one of them dies.
Blow people's arms off, yeah!
Yeah. It's, it is very much an interesting start to something that has potential, and although as a big Matsumoto fan I will be following it, obviously it's not one that I think immediately captures your attention compared to some of his other works. I would argue all of the other works that we've gotten, aside from maybe Blue Spring. But I think that's also reflective of it being a relatively earlier work in his, catalog as well. So
it's newer than Tech on Kinkreet, but
but that's not that much newer.
No. Yeah. And I guess I had two sort of things to say about number five. First is that, you know, with every work Matsumoto puts out, he's always experimenting with some new stuff in the visual department. In this case, it's the interplay between the child's drawings and the world of this fantasy, which he plays with in some very interesting ways that I was enjoying looking at very much. The character designs here also very much reflect, like, what a child would come up with, so they're very off the wall. Which is a lot of fun. And then the other thing... Oh, I also really liked that sequence that was, like, the propaganda cartoon that was in, like, a Tezuka style.
Yeah, it was great. Was cute. I love that. I also really loved the, like, chapter zero when with the large elk or deer.
That was beautiful.
It was beautiful. And yeah, it's...
I read that twice.
Because it's sort of implied from that, that's our prequel chapter, that our main character, or number five, as a child, and that experience, and then perhaps that influencing his decisions later on as an adult. Or, you know, maybe this whole rest of the series is this same kid imagining the future. We don't know yet. But it is really, you know, there's a lot going on. It is beautiful. I really liked, it was creepy, but I really liked when the twins, that lady went to, like, say hi to the twins.
That was so just, good, like, too. They just, like,
out.
And, like, great. All of the, like, when they're talking telepathically with number one, and they're, like, huge, and the world is, like, their little oyster. That's great. I like those twins. I guess next volume's gonna showcase them, so that should be fun.
There's a lot of really interesting little bits and pieces, and it'll be curious, or I'm curious to see how it all pulls together over the course of the next three omnibus that we get.
But I did want to bring up, the second thing I wanted to bring up was, the things that made me uncomfortable, that tend to make me uncomfortable across Taiyo Matsumoto's work, but I found them more uncomfortable in this one. The first one being that, so, there are black characters in number five, and visually they're not great. And specifically, Taiyo Matsumoto tends to like to make, like, one-off characters that are just, like, one visual gag, which is fine, but in this one, it's just, like, the, you know, wise old grandfather character has an afro that's just, like, bigger than him, and that's, like, the joke, because the younger one has an afro, and I was just like, that's not a funny joke, you know, because he keeps getting, like, cats and shit stuck in his hair, and I was like, I don't know. You know, maybe a black person could make this joke into a funny joke, but, like, someone who, you know, doesn't deal with, like, having black hair or, like, having had an afro, knowing people with afros, like, making that joke just feels really icky. Mm-hmm. So that was one thing. And then the character of Matryoshka. So Taiyo Matsumoto tends to avoid writing about girls and women. He does a pretty good job of making it not too noticeable of an absence. Like, he'll write about, you know, boys in an elementary school who, you know, think that girls are icky, right? Or he'll write about the Yakuza.
Yeah.
But it is, like, having reread several of his things in a row for this podcast, a very noticeable absence, and when he does include women, with Cats of the Louvre being a notable exception, I would say, they're not great. They're not good. They tend to be props more than anything, and he seems to find it hilarious that girls just talk about boys and how they look and, like, kissing and stuff, which is a very juvenile way of looking at the world, and also, the fat jokes can stop anytime. Mm-hmm. That would be great if those could stop a little bit. Because Cats of the Louvre definitely still has that, and that's one of his most recent works. And it's also present here in number 5, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Don't disagree. I would argue that the female characters in Sunny have a bit more to do.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah.
But overall, I think we're on the same page for all of that. It's not like... Again, it's not an excuse. It's less egregious than some contemporaries, but that it's still a problem and it's still something that should be recognized. And, you know, if any of those things are things you're particularly sensitive to or just don't want to engage with, then, yeah, absolutely make the informed decision and avoid. And it's, again, a call to any creator can better themselves, right? Like, it's not... It's not okay, yeah, that's fine. It's like, no, be better, right?
Yeah, right.
You can enjoy someone's work. You can enjoy someone's work and still want them to be better.
Yeah. I would say if you enjoy someone's work, then you should want them to be better.
Exactly, you know? Yes. Indeed.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm going to keep reading the series. It was just those things happened to stick out. But yeah, so that is number 5. And then with that, we started with, I guess, the two most fantastical works that we've gotten of his in English. And he does tend to bring a very strong surreal touch to his work, so I kind of wanted to move on. I guess we can start with the most recent one that we've gotten from him. Well, most recent in terms of, like, what he's drawn most recently.
Yeah.
Which, we brought up just in passing a couple times already, and that is Cats of the Louvre, which is a beautiful hardcover book.
Yeah.
I love it. It's a good coffee table book, because it's got, like, you know, some beautiful spreads in there of Taiyo Matsumoto's wonderful cat drawings of cats just absolutely overtaking the Louvre. Giant cats.
It's an interesting one because, for those who don't know, every so often the Louvre Gallery in Paris kind of commissions a work from various comics creators. In the past, other mangaka to do this have been Araki, so creator of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure, Jiro Taniguchi, who has done, you know, a bunch of stuff, Naoki Urasawa, we recently got his in English as well, But this is Matsumoto's, which is basically they let them have free reign over, you know, whatever, just so long as it involves art, the Louvre and notable pieces from the Louvre, recognizable artwork, sculpture.
Yeah, because, like, Araki just made his Louvre commission into one of his Rohan spinoffs.
Yes.
And it's great.
It is great. But, so you see a wide breadth of, obviously, it's not just mangaka that they get to do this, but a lot of just different comics creators from around the world. Notably, it was somewhat of a surprise, I think, not only to me, but for a lot of people, that we actually got this in English, because prior to Viz licensing this, most of the Louvre comics had been physically published in French and in English by sort of the Louvre's actual print house. Like, they... Rohan at the Louvre and also Guardians of the Louvre, which is the Jiro Taniguchi book, had been released as, like, editions to be sold at the gift shop. But they're they're pretty short, like, less than 100 pages, sort of comics, full color, whereas Matsumoto's is a 2 or 3 volume, like, full series about these cats that run around this gallery and their lives. And so it was not only notably longer, but was notably absent from the Louvre's catalogue, outside of the Japanese edition, which did get, like, a standard tankobon release. It wasn't one that I think a lot of people expected to get licensed, and maybe in a similar sense, neither did they, or the Naoki Urasawa one was a little bit of a surprise too, but happily we did get it, and happily Viz did such a beautiful job releasing their omnibus edition.
I love the spine. I'm looking at it right now, like, with the cat eyes. It's so good.
Beautiful, beautiful texturing to the entire book as well, the covers.
Yeah, it goes well with Sunny, I would say.
Yes, yeah, similar sort of release.
This is the story of a little kitty named Snow Baby who has the power to enter the worlds of the paintings at the Louvre, and he likes to spend his days exploring different paintings. He's absolutely in love, enamored with everything in the Louvre. But he comes into conflict with the other cats of the Louvre, who live, I guess, up in the rafters. Whatever, you know?
Yeah.
In the back. who the night guards of the museum know about and sort of harbor. But if anybody else found out about them, they would be forced to leave. And they consider Snow Baby's daily adventures to be a threat to their safety. And it kind of goes from there. It also follows one of the night guards, a new hire, and one of the museum tour guides who is coming to be a bit disillusioned with her job.
She's kind of been there, done that, run the gamut for far too long, it seems.
Yep.
And is trying to, I guess, re-inspire herself, to rediscover the magic
of the Louvre.
That brought her to the Louvre in the first place.
Yep. And this is, after all, an elaborate advertisement for the museum, the Louvre, so I wonder if she'll rediscover the magic.
I mean, who knows? It can be a bit of a surprise for all of us. I must say, like, I'm not that upset that the Louvre gets spotlighted, obviously because these are commissioned pieces, but, like, it is a really wonderful gallery. It's always super overcrowded, but it is a really if you're into that thing, like, it's a beautiful slice of art history there, and yeah. great, like, actual French history, with the gallery itself. So I do recommend a visit for any of those wanting to go to France, once the yeah. global pandemic is over. But maybe stay away from the Mona Lisa, and you'll have a easier time of it, because the other stuff is also good, way less crowded.
Yeah, right. That is the message, I think, of the book overall as well. There's the one dude who really loves the Mona Lisa, but the message overall seems to be, please look at the rest of the museum also.
Yes, we literally have tens of thousands of pieces of artwork here from so many periods of history, and I mean, they're all notable. Like, they wouldn't be here if they weren't worth some note. So maybe don't try to get your Mona Lisa selfie, and maybe instead discover something you're maybe more interested in.
And you have to look closely at every painting, because Snow Baby might be there.
Yes. I can tell you now, there's a lot of cats, like, painted cats in artwork in the Louvre. So you have your absolute choice.
I guess... And this work also is a joy to read if you're an art lover, because it is just filled to the brim with love for the museum and the art, and viewing the art. So, yeah, that's nice. Also, the cats look like they are rejects from the Cats live-action movie adaptation.
Yes.
And I love that about them.
it certainly brings a whole new level of, like, entertainment out of the book, because it predates that terrible, terrible film by many years, but the spirit is strong and the heart is willing.
The spirit is strong. Yep. You know, maybe the spirit of this book possessed, what's-his-face who directed that movie, the Les Mis guy.
I don't remember
his name.
I remember, but
he doesn't deserve it.
No. I mean, Taiyo Matsumoto would never digitally remove all of the cat buttholes, let's be real.
That... Oh no, he would make extra care to draw them, for sure. I don't want to talk about the number of naked children that are in his books. It is a cultural thing, I promise. Not every culture is as weird about, like, naked infants as we are in America.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that doesn't mean I have to like it. Anyway, that's Cats of the Louvre. Also, it's done in this beautiful watercolor style that's, like, so gorgeous. There's a lot of charcoal as well when you get into the museum at night. So, just super rich, beautiful illustrations.
Yeah, and we mentioned it a little bit with number 5, but Taiyo Matsumoto really does adapt, or he kind of utilizes a completely different style of art for each and every work that he does.
It's still recognizably him, but it's always different. Yes.
His character work, character design, character work is very obviously him, but the worlds that they live in are completely unique to each work. And in that way, it does make all of his titles really stand out and shine on their own merits. And you see this a lot more with the fantastical stuff of just how much, fantastical elements he can pull into that. using somewhat unconventional art styles, which his art style is already unconventional, so it's really interesting to compare various books and titles from him.
Well, next we've got another that is sort of doesn't take place in like a fantasy world, but has strong surreal and fantasy elements, which is Go-Go Monster, which has been around in English for a while. I feel like people just didn't realize it existed.
Yeah, it's an odd little book. It has like a cardboard slip thing to it.
Yeah,
it's a hardcover book. Weird. And the cardboard slip is unusual because it's, like, just straight-up cardboard with exposed edges as well. I don't know. It was an interesting choice from Viz, I gotta say. But the book itself is really lovely. Again, a really nice hard cover from them. And containing, well, the Japanese was a single volume. And this just duplicates pretty much exactly the Japanese release, slipcover and all.
Slipcover and all. Because slipcovers are a very normal thing here, so. But it kind of sounds like maybe Viz didn't know what they were doing.
Viz is like, I don't, what are we doing? What is this?
Well, the Japanese release has it. But it's really pretty, though, the illustration on the slipcover and underneath it. This one is So My Jam. yeah, oh man, Go-Go Monster. Okay, so this is about a kid named Yuki, who... He's a little different from the other boys in class. He's a third grader. He doesn't really have any friends, except for one of the groundskeepers, who he calls Mr. Gans, I think. And he just spends all of the free time that he has with this groundskeeper and, helps him out with the garden. At this point, a lot of the garden is actually stuff that he's grown and takes care of. Sometimes he hangs out over in the rabbit pen with another strange kid, named IQ, who wears a box over his head, who takes care of the rabbits. And, yeah, basically we get a new transfer student named Makoto, I think. Who the other kids, he ends up sitting next to Yuki in the classroom, and the other kids warn him not to talk too much to him. But he ignores them because he's a good kid. And yeah, he talks to Yuki, and Yuki tells him all about this other world that he sees, and the leader of the other world that he calls Superstar, and all of the monsters and spirits that live around the school, and how he has a lot of anxiety because he feels like those monsters are getting further and further away from him. And things kind of escalate from there. The book follows seasons, so it starts with spring and then summer, fall, and winter. And then the following spring is the epilogue, I believe.
It really dives into, again, this uncertain... Well, there's a level of fantasy here. It's very much within the imagination of these children and how they perceive the world. Or this one kid especially perceives the world. And it is really interesting. Again, one of the great strengths of Matsumoto's works is how... genuinely he's able to capture that young child like idea of existing in a place that may not understand you, that may not fully make sense to you as well, and how as as young people, we kids, you know, rationalize or explain things in their own terms and experience the world mm-hmm. in sometimes a wholly unique way that is very unique to children.
Yeah. I really love the interplay of reality and fantasy in this one. Mm-hmm. It's very much playing with Yuki's uncertainty and this cusp that he's sort of at between childhood and adulthood, and the terror that he feels because of that, because he feels mm-hmm. like he's losing something and gaining something that he doesn't want. Like he's being torn away from everything that he knew, essentially. And that gets represented by this general confusion and uncertainty throughout the book, where as readers, we don't know what's real and what's just in Yuki's head. We don't know if this school is really haunted. There's sort of this theme of basically the fourth floor of the school, because of the declining population, there's less classes needed within the school, so the entire fourth floor is just sort of abandoned. So, of course, the kids say, oh, it's haunted. And Yuki says that's where Superstar and all of the monsters are. And he mm-hmm. tells Makoto, you should never go up there. And, of course, you know, the whole escalation at the end of the book is that they go up there. Well, Yuki goes up there first, Yuki and IQ, and discover that actually a fifth floor has appeared. And they end up sort of getting lost in that liminal space, I guess, and Makoto has to explore the fourth floor to try to get Yuki back before something terrible happens to him. But there's, like, this ongoing theme throughout that of where, like, you see Makoto just drifting from classroom to classroom going, I'm cold, I'm so cold. Which seems to suggest, perhaps, haunting ghosts. The supernatural. So, I don't know, I like spooky things, so I liked the interplay of the supernatural and, I guess, hallucination, not mm-hmm. knowing what's real, not knowing what's supernatural forces trying to fuck with you.
Yeah, no, it absolutely does. And I think also, like, regardless of whether or not in reality those ghosts and supernatural things exist, for kids, they do exist, right? Like, that's part of their worldview, and it's part of how they, again, understand this, what's going on around them. Yeah, sure, the top floor is closed because there's not enough students, but again, that rumor mill is so quintessentially, like, actually how kids think and talk, and, you know, rumors build, and this kind of awe and interest. It brings a special, sometimes scary, thrilling, exciting, interesting element to an otherwise pretty mundane life from an adult perspective. And that's something that Taiyo Matsumoto really captures very well across a majority of his series, especially those dealing with really young kids, elementary school kids.
Yeah, and I mean, that's a lot of, like, what Yuki is so scared to lose, I think, throughout the mm-hmm. book as well. But also we see that, you know, he does have to lose it because it's also making him miserable, right?
Uh-huh.
And also making it difficult for him to relate to Makoto, even though you can tell, like, he's trying to be all surly about it, but he really just wants to be friends with this kid who's his mm-hmm. age, you know?
Yeah.
And then I also really like the relationship between him and the groundskeeper. It's very sweet. you just see, like, you know, I think at first you see the teachers sort of trying to be like, hey, you gotta stop being so weird. Like, no wonder you don't have any friends. Which is terrible, and that's not mm-hmm. what you should do. mm-hmm. But, you know, after a while, you know, the teacher realizes that, like, this relationship he has with the groundskeeper is actually doing positive things for him and starts going to the groundskeeper for, like, advice on how to handle him,
mm-hmm.
Which is what you should do.
Yes. Yeah.
And,
treat kids but like people? I just, yeah.
Yeah, well, and that's what he does, right? He's like,
mm-hmm.
you know, he doesn't necessarily think that there's, like, ghosts in the school or monsters, but he understands that whatever this thing that Yuki is seeing, it's very, very real for him, and that means that
yeah.
it exists, it's real. And so uh-huh. he just sort of, you know, accepts what Yuki tells him and responds to that. You know, he doesn't treat him like some dumb kid who doesn't know what's happening. He's, you know, yeah, this is something you're going through, and he sits and he listens. And I think that's so important for kids who feel like they're alone.
I think it's also really important for older people who think that they're alone, who are trying to, like, they don't necessarily fit in to, like, there's a reassurance of, like, it's okay to hold on to younger parts of yourself, and whilst also mm-hmm. it's okay to be growing out of things as well. I think there's a lot of ways that
mm-hmm.
a story like this can appeal to people, even yeah. if it's just appealing to the nostalgia of being a kid, right?
mm-hmm. It's a yeah, it's really good. It's definitely one of my favorites of his. I think in general I prefer his more realistic stuff, so we'll get into mm-hmm. that as we get into the last two titles here. But Go-Go Monster for me is almost a perfect marriage of what I like most about his fantasy stuff and what I like most about his more realistic stories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really does blend the two. Not only in a understandable and not realistic, but understandable and in a way that works and is very natural to the progression, whilst also still being really compelling and interesting.
Yeah. I also, in terms of the art, still really good. Obviously, he's still very much Taiyo Matsumoto. He's dealing with a lot of really trippy imagery here, a little bit of horror imagery, which is fun.
Mm-hmm.
My favorite sequence is at the end when it's, like, all dark, but, like, you can still see the drawing underneath with the just
yeah.
the lightest hint of illumination. That was really incredible. He's so good. Have I mentioned that? That he's just really good at drawing.
He's just such a talented artist that can just mm-hmm. change his art style every series, but still be very obviously him. Yes, like
do incredibly just stupid, amazing things with his art, just like it's nothing. He's good. Anyway, so the last two series we have here, I guess I'll go with the one that's sort of dealing with the same age group as Go-Go Monster,
mm-hmm.
Which is Sunny. This series is, what is it, 5 volumes?
Six.
It's in my American collection, so I think that G probably has better recollection than me. This is actually my favorite Matsumoto work. I just
mm-hmm.
couldn't reread it for this podcast due to having two collections in two mm-hmm. different countries. But this is it's about a bunch of foster kids in a foster home. Yeah. That's it, really. Like, it's their that, trials and tribulations, I guess.
It's about, I mean, all of these different kids come from pretty not great personal backgrounds. There's a reason they're in foster homes. And something that get addressed in a lot of, like, media about foster kids and stuff is this... Normally it's framed as, like, looking for a place, looking for somewhere that will, you know, look after you and value you, and which is all good, all great, absolutely. But something that's pretty unique to Sunny is showing really the reality of how these very upsetting or difficult to manage life experiences have an impact on kids, and how they outwardly express that, and how it isn't always just like a fun, happy time. It's very rarely a fun, happy time when you're battling with these feelings of abandonment, but also this conflicting idea of just wanting to see your parents or your family again, that unsurety of how to have your feelings of love for somebody who may have left you behind for work or for a relationship or for whatever the case may be, and how these kids are seen as like troublemakers, nuisances. They're very obviously like picked on and bullied from some of their classmates at school, who obviously don't have this turmoil in their lives, and how a lot of, the schools don't necessarily have the infrastructure to understand or to interact with these kids on a way that they need to. And that, again, that searching for your place in a world that doesn't necessarily seem to have a place for you. And for these kids, that kind of implicit feeling they must have of rejection from just being in this situation first and foremost, and how that expresses itself across the 5 or 6 kids that we follow in this story.
Yeah, it's something that I really like across Matsumoto's work. Whether it's Tekkon Concrete or Go Go Monster or Sunny, is this incredible compassion that he has for, I guess, the quote-unquote problem kids in school. He always, you know, there's always a seeking to, you know, understand them and, like, the ways in which, like you said, that they may have developed some not-so-healthy coping mechanisms or, you know, their frustration, their restlessness might come out in unhealthy ways. Even in, like, Tekkon Concrete, where obviously Black is, like, basically an axe murderer. the series, you know, never lets you stop remembering, like, where that violence is coming from. You know, it's this very deep, dark well in his heart that didn't just get there by, you know, nature, you know.
Yeah, there's been very obvious failings in on multiple levels from
family, and essentially from just a system that, you know, leaves people out, like, very fundamentally. A system that doesn't have a place for everyone. Which is so sad. And now I'm, like, images of Penguin Drums, like, Child Broiler are coming to my mind. Because it's the same message, right?
It is. It's very similar. And I mean, for me, similarly to you, I love Sunny's probably my favorite of Masamoto's work. Maybe par with Ping Pong, but it's just it works so well, and it has such compassion for these kids who within the system do get forgotten, do get left behind, do get dismissed as, you know, troubles kids, or, you know, disruptive, violent, whatever else, without ever, well, in Masamoto's series, he recognizes and uses that to showcase how these kids are being continually failed, right? Whereas typically it's more so, again, like in an orphan or foster kid situation, like story, we have a kid who might have some problems, but then they get, you know, they find a family or they find a bunch of other kids, and then they can just be happy. We never address any of the multiple failings of everything. Because one, that would be a downer.
The way that,
like, I understand why, but
like the fact that, like, if you're adopting a foster kid, you're not going to get, like, a perfect little angel. You're going to get someone who's been through the ringer, who's angry, who's bitter, who might, you know, not trust anyone for a very long time. Like, you know, you have to understand what you're getting into, you know, and be compassionate and big-hearted, you know?
And patient and understanding and willing to let them feel those emotions without forcing them to just get over it or accept it or move past it.
You know, why isn't it like in Little Orphan Annie? Why can't we be a perfect happy home right away?
No.
There's a lot of shit you gotta wade through, you know?
The foster
system. There's a lot of shit these fucking kids have to wade through.
We know that the foster system's, like, just broken on so many levels, and so many, like, poor people who are, whether it's due to, you know, poverty, whether it's due to abuse, whether it's due to a whole myriad of issues, end up falling through the cracks in society. And it's to be able to highlight in a small scale those kids in Sunny with such care and acceptance of these kids being, you know, themselves in all of their positives and negatives, and even if they aren't coming from the worst background, sometimes kids are just shitty anyway, like they're little assholes sometimes.
but there's always a reason for it.
Exactly, you know? Exactly, and understanding that, again, portraying children as people, as fully formed,
rounded, individuals
with their own feelings,
complicated, messy,
I mean, it's Sunny's great really every good. So often you have the cute kid that's just, like, Miss Perfect and what, and that would be a dream, right? Like, this is how we boost the birth rate. This is how we encourage people to have kids. But
I mean, in my experience, those kids are, first of all, they're generally coming from a pretty cushy home situation.
Exactly.
Very strong foundation under their feet. And a lot of times, I mean, it does come from a home that doesn't let them show their negative emotions very freely, and eventually that is going to come back to bite them.
Exactly, and that's what, more so what I'm meaning is, like, in media, we get all these cute, adorable children.
The little angels.
Like, perfect.
The Shinzo Abe,
and
fading into his face in the sky.
Exactly.
Exactly.
And so, like, I don't know anyone who's spent any amount of time like any amount of time with a kid, especially like the, you know, 12 and under set. Obviously, mm-hmm. Ray, you have a huge amount of experience with this, but I think a lot of people who know, have grown up around kids, have dealt with kids, whether on a professional or familial or whatever level, know that, like, they're not, it's better to, well, they, yeah, you can interact with them as people, right? Like, they're not just these cute, adorable little sap balls that, you know, yeah. try to make you want to have kids. Yeah. Like, they can be
They cute. Understand things, like, in the capacity that they can. I mean, you kind of have, you know, people forget mm-hmm. that, like, you have to empathize with the person you're talking to on some level, no matter who you're talking to. Like, everyone has different experiences. So it's like, you can talk about the same things to kids that you would have talked to an adult. I mean, not like taxes, but like, mm-hmm. you know, philosophical crap. Like, kids think about all kinds of things. You just have to put it into words that they can understand. You know?
Mm-hmm.
Don't talk down to them. Just, you know, modify your words a little bit to the sort of more narrow world that they're experiencing. And kids are amazing. Kids are amazing.
They are. They can be great. They also can be a pain in the ass, little shit. And that's wonderful. Like, we want
so
that.
Can I.
Exactly.
Kids are infinitely more amazing than people give them credit for, and infinitely more dumb than anyone can possibly imagine.
Mm-hmm.
And also, people who make hating children part of their personality are deeply annoying, and I would like y'all to stop.
They're lame. Like, I just, I understand not wanting to have your own children. That is a perfectly legitimate, you know, decision and belief, yep. but to be actively hostile towards children is the worst, and I do not respect
so
you.
Annoying. They always think they're doing something too,
mm-hmm.
fighting the patriarchy or something, and I'm like, no, you're just like antagonizing a child.
you're just actually being really aggressively terrible to a human that has been alive for maybe a decade, and, I mean, yeah. at one point you were that small and that stupid and that, like, out of control. I'm sorry. Yes. There's just no.
Yes. No excuse. You know, I'm looking at you two over there, and I can see one of you really has a lot of growing up to do, and it's not the 10-year-old.
Yes.
Anyway, speaking of growing up, let's talk about teenagers now.
Yay.
This is the last major series that we have to talk about. This was, oh man, this was a white whale for so long for so many
so
people.
Long.
We have it now, and it's wonderful, and the books are beautiful. This is Ping Pong, which has an anime directed by Masaaki Yuasa, which is absolutely brilliant. It's a brilliant adaptation, and you should watch that,
yes.
as well as read the manga.
It also has a really good live-action film version, which got a DVD release in the US. Like, you can actually find
wow.
it legally with subtitles around.
Yeah.
And that's also really good, so I recommend that
good to
one
know.
Too.
As the title suggests, this series is about ping pong. It's about the sport of table tennis, and specifically two high school boys named Hecko and Smile, that's their nicknames, who have been playing table tennis together since they were kids. And they're both very accomplished players that have both hit two different ruts in their careers,
mm-hmm.
and the series sort of follows them. Through that rut, and rediscovering their love for the sport, facing off a bunch of different very challenging opponents, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, finding themselves, growing up, et cetera, et cetera. Coming of age sports manga.
I mean, it also, like, it plays a lot into this idea of inherent talent, and
mm-hmm.
when you're a talented kid and you have a very obvious talent for something and people praise you for that talent, it can go one of two ways, neither of which are that great, that's sort of the two projections that we see with these characters, because they are both inherently pretty gifted at this particular sport. They've been playing it a long time, they've enjoyed it, one a little more begrudgingly than the other, over the course of their lives, but again, it's that idea of, like, that hard work versus talent, but also how do different talented people cope with a similar situations, and also how people who have an inherent talent for something, how they react to failure. And that's most notably what we see over the course of the series with Pekko, how being kind of confronted with not advancing as well as he wanted to, of not doing...
Well,
not being,
just like not being the literal best.
Exactly. Not having all of these great, amazing, like, winning everything, because he...
Yeah, getting up to the upper echelons and realizing that there are a lot of talented people in the world, not just him.
Yes, there's a lot of talented people, and it's those talented people who then put in the hard work, practice, are self-motivated, et cetera, who ultimately, like, you can't just cruise in on talent once you reach a certain point. I mean, cruising through life can be easy a lot of the time, but it doesn't guarantee
success. It's not fulfilling, man.
Yeah. But it doesn't guarantee you success in the long run either. It doesn't allow you to... perfect example is, once you do find that failure, how you react to that and how you take that in stride, or don't take it in stride, as the case may be. So, yeah, it's really, really wonderful at not only comparing these two people who are very talented at this sport, who are very good at what they do, but kind of split off in different directions because of that, but also how they interact with each other, especially as they have known each other for so long, they do have this friendship and this understanding and this respect for each other, and coming to terms with that as teens, being a bit more upfront with understanding their idolization or hero worship, in a certain sense.
Yeah, and I also like that we get not just those two, but multiple other sort of rival opponent characters who also explore different aspects of this talent versus hard work dynamic. We have Dragon, who I guess is, like, the main opponent, who, like, his team, he comes from, like, the best table tennis school in the area, and, like, for him, like, table tennis isn't fun. It's not a sport. It's pain. So we see this sort of, you know, when your talent and hard work are taken so far that, like, you just can't even enjoy it anymore, you know? He has to go, like, throw up before every match because he only associates negative emotions with table tennis at this point. And then from the same team, like, you have Demon, who's just, you know, he works so fucking hard, but, like, once he gets up into the upper echelons, he just doesn't have the talent.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, coming to that realization and, like, the heartbreak and the despair that's, like, I'm just never going to be one of these kids.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, it's not fair. There's no reason for it. I just can't.
Mm-hmm.
And then, the character of Kong Wenga, who, is explored more in the anime, I think. But he's also in the manga. He's coming from China. He's basically exiled, right? Like, they're like, yeah, you're gonna go, like, coach these kids in Japan for a little bit. And he doesn't speak a word of Japanese, and he's like, what is this shit? I don't want to do this. And, like, him sort of also rediscovering his love for the sport outside of just, like, the ego boost that it gives him. Mm-hmm. You know, how it feels to train rookies and, you know, actually, like, play as a student rather than, like,
mm-hmm.
the best of the best.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a good, solid cast. I like the coaches as well. They're good.
Mm-hmm. It also, I appreciate, like, this is a very sports, I mean, it's obviously about ping pong and it's about sports, but this is a very sports manga-centric criticism that I have, not for ping pong, but for kind of the sports genre in general, that ping pong pretty deftly avoids for the most part, is this, and Haikyuu is probably the best other comparison that did this really well, is that by the end of it, for these kids, like high school athletes who are inherently talented at something and have an interest and a passion in a sport, most notably, it doesn't ultimately mean that that's your entire life and that's what you have to decide for yourself once you get past, you know, like, not everyone is meant to be a professional athlete. Not everyone's interested in being a professional athlete. And the way that the series resolves both Smile and Pekka's lives and the continuation of their story past high school, I think is really well done, because it kind of exemplifies who they are as people and what they discover about themselves over the course of the series and what mm-hmm. ping pong means to them. And it can be just as valuable to somebody as a hobby or a pastime or an interest from high school versus like a professional career that you dedicate your life yeah. to.
I feel like yeah. the characters who end up going on to further their sports careers, it makes sense who does it
mm-hmm.
and who doesn't. Yeah, it's good. It's amazing how expansive of, like, a story that this manages to tell in just two thick volumes.
Mm-hmm.
I also, like, bringing back to Taiyo Matsumoto as a creator, I will say that we have done an episode on sports manga, and we did talk way too much about ping pong, so I recommend checking out that episode if you want to hear more thoughts about ping pong specifically, and how yes. it fits into our thoughts on sports manga overall.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of Matsumoto, something I really like about Ping Pong is, again, the incorporation of the surreal. It's obviously a very realistic story. This is just kids playing ping pong. There's no weird shenanigans going on here. but we do have, like, ongoing visual motifs that, mm-hmm. and repeated almost slogans for each character that are very, very Matsumoto, I feel like. And the way that those motifs are used throughout. For Smile, it's like this robot. He is very, like, another character who's very sort of neurodivergently coded, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And handled very well, like those characters have been in other stuff, like Go-Go Monster, Tekkon King Creed. Yeah, Smile's handled so well. He's such a... I love everybody. I love everybody.
Yeah, they're all good kids.
But Smile is, I really like his whole arc isn't, like, you know, him learning that, like, the peculiarities, I guess, compared to some of the other characters in, like, how he expresses himself or how he responds emotionally to the world around him. Mm-hmm. Instead of, like, realizing, you know, the error of his ways and becoming a more open person, like, he realizes that that's just, like, how he is and that he can harness those things as his strengths. And that Pekko has known this about him all the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
Which is... We need more stories like that, but, like, just say that, like, it's okay to see the world a little differently than other people. And not just okay, but, like, that can be your strength, you know?
Uh-huh.
It's not necessarily even a negative. It depends on how you look at it, you know? But anyway, I have a lot of feelings about Smile. But, he's got this robot that's, like, his sort of visual motif or metaphor. And the catchphrase over and over that replays in his head when he's playing ping pong. That's, like, you know, something that happened when he was a kid where, I don't remember. It was, like, I think he cut his finger and Pekko licked it and was, like, your blood tastes like iron. Or tastes like metal, and that, like, ends up being a pretty multi-layered metaphor for him as a character, and he just repeats that in his head as he's playing, my blood tastes like metal, my blood tastes like metal.
Mm-hmm.
And then for Pekko, it's, like, this superhero character that he used to play as a kid, whenever Smile was getting picked on, he would be, like, you know, call the hero's name 3 times and he'll arrive. So it's, like, very... That ends up being, you know, a layered metaphor for him. And, mm-hmm. And for their relationship with each other. Because obviously yeah. both of these motifs are very inherently linked to their childhood friendship. And it's visually very striking. Audibly very striking. Just, like, the repeated phrasing over and over. Almost like, you know, the ball bouncing back and forth. You know, it hits on a beat. And it's got this rhythm to it. It's so good. Yeah. Oh, man.
It's so good. I highly recommend it. It, as Ray mentioned, it's 2 very thick volumes in English. It's 5 volumes, I believe, in Japanese. And just beautiful, beautiful release from Viz. It's a Flexibound volumes, so... It's not quite hardcover, not quite softcover, but really lends itself well to this particular release. And, yeah, get it.
Get it. So good. So good.
As you're able.
And the art's great, too. The art's always great. It's great here, too, and it's great in a different way than any of Matsumoto's other stuff.
Mm-hmm.
God. Ugh. I'm disgusted.
It's just so incredibly fluid with its action. You can feel, and we talked yes. about this in our sports episode, but you can really feel yep. the movement of table tennis or ping pong, which is not, I wouldn't say it's a sport that, like, is completely infatuates the world. Like, it's not It doesn't have the notoriety of, I mean, even baseball, which is a Japanese staple, but like, I don't know, basketball or a myriad of other series that typically...
I don't know.
I mean...
Yeah, I mean, certainly in America, we're like ping pong, but it is like, it's a very serious sport in Japan, but I also feel like the table tennis kids are like a very specific subset of children. It's kind of a nerdy sport, to be honest.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, and I think, and we talked about it again, maybe a little bit in the previous episode that we talked about this, but really the sports aspect was probably the largest thing withholding ping pong from being released in English for a long time.
Yeah.
Sports series, even now to a certain extent, are somewhat risky. We've seen some breakout hits over the last several years, but for a series that is about a somewhat esoteric sport,
and it doesn't even have hot boys in it.
It doesn't even have hot boys that you, well, I mean, you can imagine the boys kissing if you want, but they don't have
the
pure, they don't have the pure shippability that, like, a typical jump sport series does, it has that hurdle. It doesn't have the myriad of fangirls who are, you know, making AMVs.
It's just me and G. We're the fangirls.
So it was a bit more of a riskier bet, but I think due in part to Taya Matsumoto's overwhelming positive reputation in the West, which has only grown over the last several years, the acceptance, the wider acceptance and popularity of sports series in manga in general, and also a wonderful adaptation, which is available on streaming and on disc and whatever else you want it, from Yuasa and released by Funimation, I believe. That it finally kind of pushed it to being where Viz was like, okay, this is obviously something that people want, to the benefit of all.
And with that, I think we only got one set of questions this time, but yes, I think I'm going to go into them.
Yeah, we will, just before we get into questions, I did want to briefly mention the seventh and final of Masumoto's works that we got in English. It is very hard to find, was not in print for very long, was sort of a short story collection full of interlocked stories or interwoven stories called Blue Spring, spotlighting a group of delinquents at a particular high school. I, as someone who owns it and has read it, I would say it's not essential reading. It's very much within Masumoto's wheelhouse for this kind of disruptive look at teens, but it's not, comparatively to his other more notable works, it is something that, unless you're really a diehard fan, is probably skippable for a majority of people.
Yeah, as G says, it's very hard to find, and I have not read it, so. But yeah. So, our one set of questions from at Storied Shelves, who, again, always sends us such wonderful, thoughtful questions.
Thank you.
The first question of which is, which of his works have you read? Which, I think G just completed the answer there.
All of them. All of them that are available in English.
Not Blue Spring, but the rest of them I have read. And which were most impactful for you? they were all impactful to me for different reasons, except maybe number five so far, mm-hmm. which isn't finished, so that's not very fair. Probably Ping Pong made me cry the most.
Mm. I would say that my most impactful for me is probably Sunny, but it's really a neck and neck, you know, fight between that and Ping Pong, and in a very, very close third is Tekken Kinkreet. But as Ray said, it's very hard to not pull something out of Matsumoto's works that is just so genuine and so emotionally vulnerable, almost. And it works so well on so many levels. Again, I can't really speak to number five. It's probably, aside from Blue Spring, the weakest of his works for me so far, but again, that's not really fair to say about having read 25% of a story.
Tekken Kinkreet also has parts that are very impactful to me. Go-Go Monster is probably the one that makes me cry the second most after Ping Pong. And then obviously Sunny is my favorite work overall of Matsumoto. So, I mean, even Cats of the Louvre, there were moments that, you know, made me see something differently or really think about something that I hadn't really thought about before. I just think that Matsumoto has a very interesting perspective on the world that always gives me something to think about.
Mm-hmm.
How would you describe Matsumoto's art style? And I guess connected, so I'll say both of them. What elements would you say contribute to his method of storytelling in art, writing, etc.? So first, I guess, how would you describe his art style? It's very... The way that he draws people is very... it's going for more... Well, this is hard, actually. my art history skills are extremely rusty, apparently. But there's more realism to the way that he draws people's faces, and specifically the way that they facial expressions look, than you would normally see in manga, which is very focused on creating an ideal, right? Something that's beautiful. You know, Matsumoto's art is beautiful in its own way, but he's not very interested in drawing pretty people, I think. He's very interested in the ways that the face and the body express themselves, especially in children. And he also has a very sort of distinctive crooked line, I guess, to his work. He draws with very confident lines, but they're not straight, right? They're kind of messy looking. That's very, very him. I was just gonna say his backgrounds vary greatly depending on the series. But he is obviously very talented, and like you'll have like these beautiful spreads of like skyscrapers or a schoolyard, but he's more interested in the impression that a background gives overall. So he'll manipulate the way that something looks from how it would look in reality in order to convey a certain emotional state, for example. As opposed to someone like, you know, Mizuki or, you know, even like Tezuka or something, who would do like a very beautiful, like almost photorealistic background, and that's like the thing they're known for. Taniguchi as well. Everything is always for the purpose of getting across the emotional story that he's trying to tell.
Yeah, and I, as someone who is not like, doesn't have any art, you know, art background, art education, I would say that his his work, and especially regarding, again, his backgrounds, is very uniquely adaptable. His art style is very uniquely adaptable to whichever story he's telling. And he's able to really utilize a very wide variety of techniques expertly. Mm-hmm. Which is not fair and shouldn't be possible, but here we are. And it's just insane. Yeah, just talks to his how talented an artist he is, how well he understands the worlds that he's creating, and presumably the characters that he's building into those worlds. We've said it once, we've said it a million times. There's something very unique and different, and just in the visual style of a lot of, if not all of his works. But they are all quintessentially Matsumoto. They're all very recognizable as coming from him and being from his body of work.
And what elements would you say contribute to his method of storytelling in art, writing, etc.? I mentioned before the use of the sort of layered metaphors that build on themselves as the story goes, mm-hmm. often accompanied with sort of slogans or songs mm-hmm. that the characters repeat. As well as, like I said, the way that he will use surrealism, essentially, to manipulate character models or backgrounds in order to further whatever emotional story he's trying to tell.
Yeah, it's almost Kamatani-esque with that. The surrealism, mm-hmm. the motifs, the repeated motifs, and how that is emblematic of his characters and how they're not only emblematic to a particular character and whenever they're in a scene, but more so to their overall character arc as well. Every part of his art style, no matter how whimsical, no matter how, like, off the wall or completely fantastical, contributes to what the scene is saying and what the story is telling. Even if that is just to portray a unrealistic or a scene or a situation that is outside of pure realism. And I think that goes hand in hand it's a sign of a great mangaka or a great creator, full stop, that when you can use the art of a story to be telling more of that story than just what the actual writing is doing. It's the visual language as well as the literal language on the page.
What are some of his strengths and weaknesses? I mean, just very simply, since we've already gone over it in depth, the art, the fact that he can just draw anything that he wants to. Anything at all.
Anything, everything.
Everything. And the way that he writes kids, especially kids that are, you know, a little bit different from the quote-unquote norm, who might feel a bit outcast or weird or like they just don't belong. He mm-hmm. writes those kinds of characters, especially when they're kids, just like nobody else. Weaknesses, he does not write about girls, like mm-hmm. hardly ever. In Sunny, there's a couple girls, but they don't, I would say, get as much focus as the boys. Cats of the Louvre, one of the main characters is a girl, and she's fine. I don't really have any issues with her. She's fine. but in general, big Sausage Fest, all of his stuff. Also racialized characters tend to not be good.
Yeah.
Again, Cats of the Louvre being the exception. One of the main characters is a black dude, and he's fine. He's fine.
The various problematic elements that we've already mentioned and talked about over the course of this episode, I don't think there's anything major that we've missed. And if we have, feel free to remind us, because, you know, always happy to reassess
and be reminded. Fat people do more things than just eat lots of food, and
yes,
also are not inherently funny. So that would be, that can stop anytime.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's just echoing, I think, our earlier points when talking about these particular, well, these issues.
It in bears repeating.
Issues. Yes, it bears repeating, an acknowledgement, and a hope for, or a hope to do better for the future as well. Because, you know, can always do better.
Favorite covers. Go-Go Monster. I love that cover a lot.
Yeah, it's really, it's a really strong cover. I also really like, the Tekken King Crete. the single volume edition. I don't know about the singles. It's quite striking.
Yeah. I like the Sunny covers a lot, too. I like how you can open it up and there'll be, like, another illustration that's, like, from the same, like, I guess, quote-unquote photo shoot. I think the pair of pictures of the girl with the cat and then the girl, like, getting scratched by the cat leaping out of her arms. I knew
that was the one you're gonna say.
It's great. Honestly, nobody draws cats as realistically as Matsumoto does, because they're just gremlins.
Brilliant. Amazing.
They're cute sometimes, and then they're just gremlins. And also constantly in motion. His cats are constantly in motion. Who are some of your favorite characters? Literally everyone in Ping Pong.
Yeah. I like the kids in Sunny as well. Like, especially the main two.
Yeah, I like them a lot.
They're really good.
I like the white-haired kid a lot.
With his aviators.
Yeah. It'd be harder for me to list Taiyo Matsumoto characters I don't like, because I like the kids in Go-Go Monster, and I like Black and White a lot, too. So.
He just writes really likable characters. You know, realistically likable characters.
He writes lots of good, weird kids. Which setting was your favorite to explore? Probably the school in Go-Go Monster. It's got that, like, surreal Japanese horror game haunting style that I enjoy a lot. It's very atmospheric.
Especially because that is one of his more, like, fantasy-edged series. When we get to Ping Pong and Sunny, it is just, like, reality. Sometimes the depressing reality of life. You're like, ew. I hate that. I live that already. Why? Don't need to explore that.
No. Take me back to the fantasy. Fantasy city.
But
fantasy cities in his work also suck. So.
Exactly. Like, I was about to say, comparatively, the setting of Tekken King Crete, it's fantastical, but it's it sucks. Like, it just is the worst. It sucks
a lot. It's the worst. I'll pass. The number 5 one, too, is like, it's post-climate disaster. I'm already living that. I don't want
Yeah, I'm not keen on ending up in the fucking 70% desert world of this.
Yeah, with, like, you know, horrible natural disasters every day because the world's just dead.
Yeah.
Oh, God. I'm, like, having an existential climate crisis as we speak. So I'll hang out in the spooky ghost school.
Yeah.
Or the Louvre. I want to go to the version of the Louvre where I can jump into the paintings.
I already recommended the Louvre as, like, an actual real-life place. And if you could, like, physically just go explore the artwork in the Louvre, as in go in and explore the world of a painting, hell yes.
That'd be sick.
That'd be great.
Yeah. And that was our last question.
Yeah. Short and sweet.
Short and sweet. Only 2 hours.
Well, it's short and sweet for us. But as always, thank you everyone for listening. Thank you so much, Storage Shelves, for your wonderful questions. Very much appreciated, as always. I hope you all enjoyed this particular episode where we got to talk a little bit about one of our, well, yeah, a very wonderful mangaka who has a lot of his works available in English right now. All of them from Viz. So, majority of them.
Go buy them.
Go buy them. I presume they're all still in print. I don't know if they're in stock, just because, again, global pandemic, the whole publishing industry is screwed right now. But that you should be able to find some of them, at least.
I think all of the ones that we talked about are available digitally as well. I'm not sure about Cats of the Louvre. I didn't check that one. But the others definitely are.
Yeah. I mean, I read number 5 digitally because my print edition isn't here yet, so.
Same. Yay! Same hemisphere.
But yeah, so thank you all for listening. I hope this inspires some people to try Taiyo Matsumoto's works if you have not, or maybe some of the adaptations of said work if you have not, or if you've only read the manga, check out the anime/live actions. Next month, we are doing our series spotlight on Fruits Basket. It was rescheduled from this month. We had a couple issues, but yay, we're super excited to talk about one, Ray's favorite series, but
yay!
To be able to talk about it with the wonderful Loom Ranma Yasha, who will be joining us as a guest. So the three of us can all just, get super excited about Fruits Basket. And hopefully you, dear listeners, also get super excited about Fruits Basket.
About Fruits Basket. It's a good time to be excited about Fruits Basket, to be honest.
Exactly. We've had a very strong anime adaptation recently, with a continuation announced for some of the side stuff. It's had the beautiful re-releases from Yen Press, with updated translation and super nice fancy covers and all that. And just kind of a rejuvenation in interest, not only from old fans and new fans coming into it, but also from Takaya herself. It's been a good time.
Yep. I've certainly been enjoying it.
We all know you just read it for your tiny rodent hand agenda.
That's a deep cut for the audience.
Um,
That's a lot to reveal to them about me at once.
That is, listen to our first episode, our very first episode, if you have not, because then that joke will make a lot more sense.
I just love tiny rat hands a lot. The manga doesn't really have them. I was very excited about the new anime, reinstating the tiny rat hands, tiny rat toes.
It's all
how incredibly angry would he be with me if he knew this is how I was talking about him? He's got such a complex.
It's fine. But as always, dear listeners, if you have any questions for us or our guests, feel free to leave them either in the comments down below if you're watching this on YouTube, or you can also leave your questions with us when I tweet about it, asking for questions at Collecting G. That's where you can find me on Twitter. You can also find Ray at Whimsical Pix, P-I-X, on Twitter. Be sure to follow her, as well as her actual YouTube channel, Whimsical Pictures. You can also listen to this podcast not only on my YouTube channel, Simply G, but also Spotify, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, other podcasting platforms, Anchor FM, all of them. So you really have your choice, your pick. And yeah, with that, thank you all so much for listening. I'm Simply G. I hope you all have a wonderful rest of your month. Stay safe, stay healthy, be kind to each other. I'll look forward to spooky season, and I will see you in the next episode. Bye till then.
Bye, guys.